from the Corona Group in Corona, Queens, I bring you Ron G.
My name is Ronald. I'm an alcoholic. I've recovered from the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I've been restored to health. I'm a drunk. Plain and simple. My sober date is 1990, July the 10th. I was introduced to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1995. I was 4.5 years sober. I'm a little nervous. I'm nervous because sometimes I don't think I got drunk enough. I get nervous because sometimes I don't think I'm spiritual enough. These are the times that I'm reminded that I'm human. And as a human, I have allergies. My main allergies are nuts and alcohol. Not necessarily in that order. When I eat nuts, I have an immediate, simultaneous reaction. My lips swell up, my tongue swells up, I get hives, and all kinds of crazy things happen to my body. When I take any alcohol in my system, I have an immediate, simultaneous reaction. I want another drink. I started drinking when I was about 15 or 16 years old. But my story starts with my first conscious memories. My first conscious memories were, what am I doing here? Why am I in this family? Why can't I have what they have? They seem to be having fun. When I was 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, I played with other children. I played with my siblings, my cousins, my family. But I always felt different. The difference was they seemed to be happy with what they had, and I wasn't. I was the youngest child of 4. My sister was 11. My two brothers were 11 and 13. My father was 39 years old, and my mother was 40. I was the baby. I didn't know that I was spoiled. Where I got all their attention when they were growing up, they had little. I thought that I had 5 parents. Because somebody was always in charge of me. Somebody was always telling me I couldn't have, I couldn't do, I couldn't go. Somebody was always telling me no. I loved my family. But I just wanted to be somewhere else. This carried straight through till I was 14, 15 years old. I'm in high school now. I'm still uncomfortable. I can't run fast enough. I can't fight well enough. I'm not good looking enough. I just felt that if there was just something I could think of, one little thing that I could change, I'd be all right. I'd be the person that I know that I really was. One day it happened. Somebody said, let's get a taste. 10 o'clock in the morning. Instead of going into school, We went to the liquor store. Now, the people I was hanging out with, they didn't drink. But the people who didn't go to school, they drank. And this day, I hung out with them. It was a rough crowd. Rough crowd. People looked mean. Dressed in army fatigues. I'm talking about the women. I had a dollar, so I drank first. I drank three-fourths of that bottle of Gallo Tawny Port before somebody snatched it from me. Immediately, the effect was immediate. I can never put into words what it was like. It wasn't until I was introduced to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 47 years old that I saw the words that were spoken by Dr. Carl Jung when he said, I had an emotional upheaval and rearrangement. All of the ideas, motives, and attitudes that had guided me for these 16 years were at that moment cast to the side. An entirely new set replaced them that day at that moment. I had never been able to adequately describe what it was like to discover the solution for being Ronnie. But that's the day I discovered it, and that's exactly what happened. Immediately I ran into the, I wanted to run into the cafeteria to share my new self with my friends in fourth period lunch. And there was a guy going in the door at the same time I was going in the door, and instead of saying excuse me and letting him go first, I punched him in the mouth. Took me right out of here. For the rest of the day, I lived a horror show. I went from one boy's bathroom to the next boy's bathroom to the next boy's bathroom, and then got on the bus, and then went home, and I threw up all over the bathroom, and the bed spun, and you know the story. 2 days later, I was reaching in my pocket for another dollar. Because I didn't feel right. I wasn't sick anymore, but I didn't feel right. So I said, let me get another little taste with the fellas. But this time, we ain't drinking that Tawny Port. This time, we're going to drink Gypsy Rose, damn it. Because this time is going to be different. My alcohol career was off to a running start. Something happened to me that day I thought happened to everybody who drank. When my other friends started having a little taste at the end of the day or after the football game, you know, I was saying, oh, yeah, now I got to be some real partners. But they always wanted to go home. They always wanted to study for the test. They always had something else to do. But I kept saying, hey, man, remember that, you know, that great feeling? We want to get that again. And they said, no, no, I don't think so, not today. And I never understood that. I never understood that until I picked up the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and found out that my reaction to alcohol was different from theirs. I developed two sets of friends. The friends that I brought home to meet my parents and the friends that I hung out with. I hung out with the people who drank like me. I brought the people home to my parents that they wanted to see. Naturally, I was thrown out of high school not too long afterwards. Joined the workforce when I was 18 years old. And now I can drink like grown-up people. I can deal with grown-up women. I can go to bars. You know, I got it made. Why? Because alcohol told me everything's going to be all right. This is all part of my first step. My first step. For the next 3 years, I experimented with alcohol. When I say experimented, I don't mean Bill Clinton experiment. You know, where you you smoke but you don't inhale. I'm talking about the mad scientist. Remember the mad scientist? We take some of the blue stuff and we put it in some of the gray stuff and we see what happens. That's the way I experimented with alcohol. I tried drinking a little of this and a little of that, putting them both together to see if I could get something different. When it came to other drugs, I combined alcohol with other drugs to see what would happen. If you told me that drug was dangerous, no problem. Let me just take a drink first, and I'll try it. It was as simple as that. If Life magazine said this drug is dangerous to American youth, I'd throw it up my nose. But alcohol told me it'd be all right. I suffered from the Mobetta. You ever had any Mobetta? You know? You take something good, you take something else, and you put them both together and see if you can feel Mobetta. I love it. I loved it. You know, I was a walking chemical experiment. Alcohol told me it would take care of me. I put stuff in my nose I can't pronounce. That's amazing, isn't it? When I was 22, I said, my life ain't going nowhere here in New York. I ain't working, ain't doing nothing. I joined Vista, became a Vista volunteer, and got sent to Washington, D.C. I learned another baffling feature about alcoholism. Its ability to lay in wait and to ambush. When I got to D.C., I didn't drink. Made new friends. Got to know the lay of the land. Got to be popular. Got to doing things. Got to building up a bright future for myself. And then somebody said, let's get one. And that's all she wrote. For the next 9 years, I just started falling through false bottoms. One bottom after another bottom after another bottom. I'd been arrested so many times that my first drinking partner from New York came to Washington, D.C., couldn't find me. So he pretended he was a private detective and went to 300 Indiana Avenue and told him that I was wanted in New York. And they gave him the address that I had last used on a car that I had driven without a license. And he was able to track me down through that information. The physical problems that I have today, I'm 61 years old. I'm 60 years old. I'll be 61 in November. I'm 60 years old. I look back upon the beatings, the muggings, the fights, the bar fights, the stabbings, bullet wounds that I endured as a result of drinking. And I'm truly amazed. I feel like I'm reading somebody else's story. When I was 19 years old, they tried to cut me a brand new asshole. Excuse my language, ladies. They were stitching me up on my side. Doctors were in the back, doctors were in the front working on my face. While I was in Washington, D.C., my own first cousin took a pistol, pointed it at me, and fired from a distance of 5 feet. Caught me right here in the chest. That's my first cousin. I'm not going to tell you what my second cousin did. I started out saying that I was a drunk. I'm also a drunk that uses other drugs. And other drugs are part of my story, a big part of my story. I used to think that my story was unique until I read Bill's story. And he talked about the combination of drugs and alcohol. I'm not one of those people that use drugs in order to drink more. I already told you I suffered from Mobetta. I use drugs on top of alcohol to enable me to feel Mobetta than I was already feeling. When I fell through the last bottom in D.C., I came back to New York, and I started falling through a series of bottoms back here in New York in 1980. There are so many, I don't know where to start. My parents by this time were they were elderly. My father had started to drink some. My mother didn't quite know what to do. And my brothers and my sister were all counseling them to get rid of me, to put me out again. Sometimes when they put me out, I stay downtown in the shelters. I would go to one shelter, maybe to 3rd Street. 3rd Street would send me up to 145th Street or to the Armory. Sometimes they would send me to Brooklyn. Every single shelter I was ever sent to, I got put out of because I could not stop drinking. All they had to do was walk into my little space, open my bag, and there was my bottle. My mother let me back in the house after my father died. Well, before my father died. He was sick, and she didn't want me to die in the street. Now, this was back in the middle 80s. By the end of the 80s, she didn't care where I died. I felt hopeless and helpless. I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know what had gone wrong. I was literally living just to drink. I was able to get welfare because I had seizures. I had seizures because I drank. Because I was on welfare, I could get credit in the liquor store. There's one next door in my neighborhood. So in 1989, this is my social life. I would go once a month and get my ducats from the check cashing place, sign for them, go straight to the liquor store, pay my liquor bill, go to the bodega, pick up something for my nose. I go to the crack house on 105th Street, pick up something for the ladies, go find me a nice little crackhead, have sex for 48 hours, and that was the end of the money, that was the end of the drugs, and that was the end of everything. That was my social life for the entire year 1989. There were little side ventures to the hospitals. Pancreatitis couldn't stop me. Anybody here ever had pancreatitis? Suffer the pain of pancreatitis? That couldn't stop me. Pneumonia didn't stop me. I became resigned to the fact that I was going to die like this. I was not suicidal. I was already killing myself. I didn't need to shoot myself. I didn't need to do anything. All I needed to do was to keep on doing what I was doing and it would end soon. The thing that saved my life, and I know this is an AA meeting, and people in AA meetings want to hear how AA solved their problem. The thing that saved my life was that I never learned how to shoot pool. And I wanted to learn how to shoot pool. And I had a pool table in an outpatient treatment program at Elmhurst Hospital in Queens, New York. And I wanted to get in that alcohol treatment program. And I wanted to learn how to shoot pool. And that's what saved my life. I came out of my last hospital, not my last detox, out of the last hospital stay. And I tried to get into that program. 3 days straight, I had alcohol on my breath. When I came home after the second time, I went and got my pint of Georgia vodka and put it in the closet and said, I'm not drinking until I get in there. And I went and I got in and I came back home and I started to drink it and then I remembered, oh, they gave me antabuse. And I didn't want to be a wet brain. So I kept it there. Kept it in the closet. Stayed there 6 months. During that 6 months, I started attending AA meetings. as a requirement of staying in the clinic, had to stay in the clinic in order to stay on welfare. I needed to stay on welfare because without welfare, I couldn't get credit at the liquor store. Now, it made perfect sense to me. It made perfect sense to me. I was doing it. I had a plan. I was putting my plan into action. I felt good about that. And I was learning how to play pool. I go to this group. Whatever group I was going to, I was sitting in the back and just, you know, can't wait to get out of there. But I'm sober now. I'm having all these crazy ass thoughts. I don't see any way out of my current situation. I don't want to stay like I am. Don't have a key to the house. Got to knock on the door to get inside. Never have any money. Got to hang out with these AA losers. But I couldn't think of a way out of it, so I endured it. One day, I joined that group, nearest closest group to my house. For 4.5 years, I was a member of AA in good standing. Whatever they asked me to do, I did. Chairperson, treasurer, program chair. Whatever they asked, I made the coffee for 2 years. I kept the keys to the church. As a result of my good conduct, I got a job. Then I got a little raggedy piece of car. Then I got a girlfriend. Then I really went completely out of my freaking mind. I didn't know what I was doing. I did not know what the hell I was doing. Okay? I did not know what I was doing. She told me I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. I told her she had to be crazy. And I listed all of those things I told you about. This is what I'm doing. What are you doing? And she told me that she had found the person that had this solution. And I said, he's just trying to get in your pants. And she said, no, I tried that. He said, no. I'm not making this up. So I went out to Brooklyn and checked this guy out. Within 23 minutes of talking to this guy, he was trying to start a meeting over in Bushwick. And I went out to check him out. Now I'm 47 years old. I can't fight. You understand what I'm saying? I'm still, you know, completely out of my mind. I'm going to go out here and check him out. Now, he was the picture of NA that I always carried in my head. I made NA meetings the first 2 years that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew NA people. I knew the NA program. A lot of the people in NA were all about gold. Gold tooth, gold chains, you know, and big smiles, okay? And I walked in, it was a tall guy, dark skin, gold tooth, gold chains, you know, with a big smile holding his hand out. And I said, oh, Lord, here we go. It took him 23 minutes of sitting down one-on-one with me to convince me that he knew what he was talking about. He called me on all my shit. All of it. He said, I bet you go to meetings to tell the AA program. And I said, yes, I share, give my experience, strength and hope in, about the AA program. He said, you don't know the AA program. The AA program is in this book, first 164 pages. He said, what's in this book? I said, I don't know. He said, then you don't know the program. Now I'm getting resentful. This NA gold tooth gold. You understand what I'm saying? But then he said something that hit home. He said, you know what I can't stand? I can't stand going to meetings to hear people say they gave their will up and they took it back. Who are they to take something from God? And he opened the book. And this was the key. He opened the book to the second step question. Then he showed me in the book, God is everything or God is nothing. Who are you to take back your will from God? That was the hook. I had been avoiding God my entire sobriety, my entire life. I had been avoiding God since I could remember. I would go to church when I was a child and sit in the back, because this God of vengeance, I didn't want him having no part of me. When I went to Bible school, I was terrified that God was going to hurt me. When I started doing the things I used to do in order to stay high, I was certain that the Lord's vengeance would come down upon me with a hammer. Thor's hammer. Okay? I was very into mythology also. But he convinced me, and my journey started then and there. I went out to Brooklyn every week. He guided me through the book Alcoholics Anonymous. That day that I asked him to take me through the steps, I think was the hardest single thing I ever did in my life. I don't know where the humility came from. I went out there with a resentment with this guy. And all of a sudden, I say to him, would you guide me through the steps? Would you take me through the steps? And he said, yes. Randolph put me on this path. And it was a torturous road. I did not go willingly. We would sit with that book, and he would say, this is what it says. And I would say, no, it doesn't. Okay? He would say, this is how you do inventory. And I would say, that's not what it says. And that's how we got through the whole book. There were things in the book that for the first time in my life, my questions were answered. They're too numerous to mention. We can start with the doctor's opinion. Restless, irritable, and discontent until I can once again experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes when I pick up a few drinks. Wow. I didn't hear nothing else he said. I was stuck right there. That's it. I couldn't figure out how it always happened. Restless, irritable, and discontent. I had been restless, irritable, and discontent 15 and a half years. So I was 16 years old and took my first drink. That's it. And it went on, and it kept happening, and it kept happening. All through the book, I would come across these phrases that described what I was feeling while I was feeling it. Page 52. Useless. I was totally freaking useless. That's what was driving me insane. I was sober 4.5 years and I was useless. Couldn't take nobody through this stuff. I couldn't go to a meeting and say 90 meetings in 90 days because they didn't do that. What could I do? I was totally useless. Well, my journey started there. I'm going to come back to this little 4.5 year period I spent in the fellowship suffering from untreated alcoholism in a moment. I got to tell you this. The kind of conversations Randolph and I used to have when his 2-year-old son would let us have conversations. He would say something about the goodness of God. And I would say to him, Randolph, when am I going to have this spiritual experience? That's the kind of questions I would ask him. It says here in step 12 that I'm going to have a spirit. He says, no, it says you're going to have a spiritual awakening. Okay, when am I going to have? And then I noticed that 11 said, so I couldn't wait to get to step 11. And I started following instructions in step 11, and I come back to end. Randolph, when am I going to have this spiritual awakening? He said, don't worry, you're going to have it. I'm not kidding you. We got all the way to page 164. And I told him, when am I going to have this spiritual awakening? He said, don't worry, you're going to have it. He told me, it's now time for you to follow the instructions. So I ventured forth into the land of untreated alcoholism we now know as Queens. And I went on my first commitment. Since I've had, or was supposed to have had, the spiritual awakening. Because I thought after you got to page 164, you had a spiritual awakening. But I didn't have it. I'm making my amends as I go along. Nothing's happening. I'm feeling better. But I was frustrated because it's not what I expected. The first time I spoke was at the Jackson Heights group in Jackson Heights, Queens. It was a beginner's meeting, and I talked about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went against their tradition. Their tradition said this is a beginner's meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will talk about what it was like in the beginning. And instead, I started talking about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I was finished, I was sweating. The audience didn't quite know what to make of it. And first hand it went up, she told me, it's all right, God was just trying to shake the truth out of you. And I said, thank you. That was the first time. I just want to tell you a little bit about what happened right before that. I am so scared going into this meeting because of what I knew to be the animosity in the Queens groups towards the Big Book, that even though these people had known me for 4.5 years, I was unsure of what their reaction would be. There was a Big Book in the car. I had to wait for the time on the parking thing so I could park legally. I'd wait till 7 o'clock. And I said, well, what I'm going to do is look in the book to see if I can find some inspiration while I'm waiting. And when I turned to the book was already open to the page that quite simply said, and remember, I hadn't started my journey. I had started the journey, but I hadn't really done anything. I'm going to find it in a second. Bear with me. The book was open to page 163. 164. But I will not have the benefit of contact with you who wrote this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So you must remember that your real reliance is always upon Him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Now that's not what I'm looking at. This is, the bottom line was, the book opened by itself to the page that told me I was jittery and I was alone. We know you are jittery. We know you feel alone. That you couldn't possibly recreate what we have done. But you can, because you have now just tapped into a power much greater than yourself. Those were the pages it was open to. Those are the words that I never forgot. I have tapped into a power much greater than myself. And so I ventured forth with those words in my mind and did the best I could with what I had. And I've been doing that ever since. I've never stopped. I come from a very lonely place. When I went through the book in 95, there weren't any Big Book meetings in Queens. I didn't know of anyone who had done the book. The people that had come to our group had accused us of being murderers. had accused us of killing people, had banged on the gavel, and said that what we were doing was BS and what they were doing was truth. Being in that group and hearing that, I was instantly resentful. I was instantly down on anything that had anything to do with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want that to happen to me. When I went through the book, I was looking for that stuff. I had a preconceived notion that it was in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a preconceived notion that it was going to turn me into a Big Book Nazi, and I was looking out for those things that were going to make me be like that. I didn't find any. I didn't find any. What it told me was that I had a code. And that code was love and tolerance of other people's point of view. It told me to be an effective sponsor. I had to have no access to grind. No access to grind. Just a sincere desire to be helpful. That's all I saw. That I wasn't to push people because I would destroy my chance of being useful to them at a future time. These are the things that I remember from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Those were the things that I found. Just some of them. There was to be no name calling. There was to be no talking down to. If this was a message that they found to be most effective, then who am I to change them? I come from a fellowship that is sick by definition. I come from a fellowship. Did anybody here ever play the game telephone when you were a child? Get a line of kids, 5, 6 kids, and one kid whispers a word into, and on down the line, and the last person, he says the word, and there's nothing like what the first person said. That's what's happened to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. They put the written word down somewhere in the past, and they're passing along by word of mouth what sounds good. We need help. I've always found it to be paradoxical that when I'm with people in fellowship of the Spirit, there is a certain pervasive attitude that is reserved for people in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I understand that these people, like myself, were ignorant of the solution to the problem. They're not stupid. They're not malevolent. Some of them are a little weird. They're good intentioned, though some are very selfish. But above all, they need help. If there's a problem and this group of people has a solution, and this group of people does not have the solution, then I would ask that this group of people share that solution with the group of people that doesn't. By attending AA meetings. There are some people in this room that I have seen in AA meetings carrying the message. I just don't see enough of it. We have meetings where there is no recovery going on whatsoever. There are no recovered alcoholics. People are still trying to do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous by the step book. And you know, the step book was not designed for that purpose. It's okay to do it by Hazelden or to do your fourth step by something based on the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe you weren't as affected by alcohol as I was. I'm a true alcoholic. Without spiritual help, I drink. But not everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous is like me. Some are potential alcoholics. Some are here by accident. Regardless, we need help. On the way over here, I jotted down a few things. I have no idea where they are. From the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that speak to this very situation. All it boils down to is one alcoholic with this solution in his hand helping another alcoholic out of the gutter. Putting aside prejudice. Laying aside prejudice. Laying aside whatever prejudice we have against the fellowship. Laying aside whatever personal history we had with the fellowship. I tried it didn't work. They told me 90 meetings in 90 days and I got drunk. Putting aside all of that. How can we say that this alcoholic deserves help? And by the luck of the draw, this guy who came through the fellowship does not. They're not going to welcome us with open arms. And they're going to argue with us. Why? Because they're obstinate. They're sensitive. They're all the things that we were according to this book. All of the things that we were according to this book. You find in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not easy, but my friends, no pain, no gain. My greatest fear is that two fellowships would eventually emerge. And I see it happening in New York. The numbers down there are dwindling. The number of people attending Big Book meetings is growing. I spoke at a small meeting this past Sunday. At the hospital where I got sober. They have a Big Book meeting there now. So it's growing. But in the meantime, close by, thousands are suffering. That's part of my message. When I got here today, I didn't know what the format of the meeting was. And right before the meeting started, I was informed that I had to talk about all 12 of the steps. My experiences with all 12 steps. Synopsis. A lot of what you heard had to do with step one. You may not have noticed it, but I was totally insane while I was sober. All the feelings I felt until the age of 15 were totally off the wall. Had I not found the solution to myself when I was 15, I think I would have been committed by the time I was 25. I could not go on that way. I was insane sober. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was insane sober. The insanity of alcohol would descend and I would drink. I turned my will and my life over to God before I became willing to consider my own concept of God. I could no longer exist the way I was. I just said, God, I can't do this. I was still drinking. I just can't do this. I became resigned to my fate. My God was alcohol. I was going to die by the hand of alcohol. I came to believe that AA could restore me to sobriety, not sanity, that AA could return me to sobriety, not sanity. See, because I was scared of sanity. Sanity was what happened before I started drinking. That's what I thought. I had to come to believe that my concept of God was real. And to do that, I had to sit with that portion of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1995 and come up with a concept that worked. And I did it by going back and going back and going back until it dawned on me what the man was saying. Underlying the totality of things, that's what got me. Underlying the totality of things. That was my second step. I made my decision and immediately got into the fourth step. My fourth step was hard. Not because I was unwilling to look. I was scared. I had this idea in my head that this fear inventory was going to make me fearless. I was totally whacked out. He was patient with me. We got through the fear inventory, got through the sex inventory, and I started talking. At the end of my fifth step, I was disappointed because I didn't know God better. But I still had hope that I was going to have this spiritual awakening. I understood very well what I was turning over in step seven, my will. I wasn't too clear about what the will was. Was it my thinking? Was it my memory? But whatever it was, he could have it. And it was that thought that enabled me to make the list. It's not my show. Make the list. It's not my show. Put her name down. Making amends, it's like walking in this room. I knew that once it got started, I'd feel better. All right? Making amends the first time, family member, piece of cake. The woman was 80-something years old. My second amends, I had to sit in silence while people brought up things that I didn't remember about my drinking and the things that I had done to my mother. Amends started popping up. I'd get a little position in my community organization and realize that the person that I now have to report to once a month, I almost destroyed his whole program and got him cut off from city funding forever and ever and ever through my drinking. And I had to make amends on the spot. Said I'll be right back, went home, got the car, came back, sat down with him. Today's one of my best friends. Not everybody is glad to see me. I think one person is hiding. I lived common law with a person for 7 years. And she seems to have disappeared. But I'm willing. There are people who are actively looking for her. She's been married and separated, and I don't know what her current name is. But that's happening. And I'm prepared to make those amends whenever it comes up. I had no idea about the bondage I was in. I was not clear about it. You can't tell a person who's in a boat what they're into. I mean, if I'm in the boat and you're outside the boat, you can say, hey, man, you're all screwed up. But I'm in the boat and I don't know. With clarity, I have had a daily reprieve contingent upon my spiritual condition. My spiritual condition. The way, did anybody here ever carry suitcases and then put them down and your arms go like that? That's what I feel every single day of my life. I wake up and they go like that. That's the freedom of the 10th step. That daily reprieve after all those decades of trying to get to the store at 8 o'clock in the morning or whatever time it opened. And today my arms go like that. Continued to look for those four horsemen. Selfishness, self-centeredness, dishonesty, fear. I'm trying to be as honest today as I can. I'm not perfect. I was talking to Phil on the way over here, and I mentioned that someone we both know, when that person passed away, they made a tape of his last speech. Not speech, but the last time that he spoke. And I couldn't listen to it, because I get emotional. I couldn't listen to it. But I did hear the part where he talked about being ready to die. And he said it, I am an alcoholic, I have fully recovered. And then he said something else that let me know that he was ready to die. When I get to that point and I'm fully recovered, I'll be ready to die. I'm not there yet. I'm on a journey. I hate to use the word I am a recovered alcoholic because I have so much work to do. I'm an alcoholic who's been restored to health. I still have to maintain my health. That little bit of work I did doing these steps, that was just preparation to get out here and do some work. For me, life and work are interchangeable. It's all the same thing. I'm happy to be alive. And I want to share that joy with others who are dying. I've come before you, I've made my case, I've made my plea. It's up to each person in here to interpret what I've said, to like it, to not like it, to investigate it, to check it out. I'm just the messenger. My name is Ron, and I thank you for this opportunity.